Thanks for coming to this, everybody. This is very rudimentary, so I hope it can be perhaps more discussion based, because I don't know what level to start. So I thought I'd start very basic, really, and whiz through the handout that I've got, and then we can talk about more substantive problems perhaps a little later. So this series is there's four talks I'm giving, or four seminars on approaches to the study of religion, and we looked at phenomenology last week and its philosophical roots mainly, and this week we're going to look at sociology of religion, and we've got two more, one on psychology and one on politics. So actually we could have subsumed anthropology under this as well, I suppose, but so you know, I'm not a sociologist, so I'm hardly qualified to speak about sociology of religions, but one of the beauties of this job is that you can talk about all sorts of things that you don't know nothing about. Thanks, Andrew. We've just started, really. So the word sociology was first coined by Comte, I think, in the 19th century. And there are three foundational theorists, I always think, particularly with regard to religion. There's Durkheim, Marx and Weber. So I thought we'd look at briefly at each of those before opening it up to a more substantial discussion, perhaps. So Durkheim's famous for his Elementary Forms of the Religious Life, which was published in 1915. And he thought that the study of what he called primitive peoples or non-literate societies enabled us to make inferences about the religion of ancient people. So that's a very common in the 19th and early 20th centuries, that when you're looking at contemporary non-literate, what used to be called primitive societies, you can make inferences about early human beings, human communities. It could be a legitimate assumption, but it is an assumption. And he focused on something called totemism in that book, which was based on the work of two anthropologists, 19th century anthropologists who worked in Australia, Spencer and Gillan. And a totem is the idea that an animal or a plant or a rock or something represents the society, represents the clan, and you've got prohibitions around it. So the clan mustn't eat the totem. So if the kangaroo clan mustn't eat the kangaroo, so it's kind of set aside, and it determines kind of marriage patterns and that kind of thing. So someone in the kangaroo clan has got to marry a kangaroo or something, or somebody from the emu clan or whatever. So it's a totemic, it's a symbol of the society, which embodies all the values of the society or the community. So that's what he focused on in that book. And from that study of Australian peoples, he came up with a functional definition of religion, which is, in translation, a religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things. It's very famous, this. That is to say, things set apart and forbidden. Beliefs and practices which unite into one single moral community called a church, all those who adhere to them. So that's his famous definition of religion. Religion is something sacred, set aside, and forbidden. So, or another example, not from Durkheim, but from Levi-Strauss, would be in South America, that tribe he studied, whose name I forget now, in Brazil, in the Amazonian jungles, you have the men's hut, and in the men's hut, where all the men live, you have these sacred pipes, and they're the symbol of the community, and you mustn't touch the sacred pipes or see them, or the women mustn't see them or touch them, so they're sacred, they're set aside, set apart from the as something forbidden and special. So these totems, a religion is a unified system of beliefs and practices which unites a body of people into a single moral community. So it's kind of, God is society then for Durkheim, and society is renewed by religion. So religion is like social glue, the glue which binds people together. So if you go to a football match or something, you know, it's that kind of, that solidification. And he emphasizes this sacred versus profane, the everyday versus these things set aside in religion. And he argued for that the social is a reality that can't be understood in terms of biology or psychology. So he tried to establish a link between social practices and kinds of society. His first book was on suicide, actually, which is quite interesting. He did a study of suicide in European countries, and found that there was a higher suicide rates in Protestant countries than in Catholic countries. Which he argued was that not a causal relationship, but the religion was a necessary condition that allowed suicide rates to be higher in Protestant countries because of the stress on individualism. Yeah. So he argued that stress on individualism, which Protestantism advocates, is conducive to higher suicide rates. And the other important thing about Durkheim is that he's a descriptive sociologist, in the sense that he's not making value judgments about suicide, whether suicide is good or bad, but simply trying to present an account of it, an explanatory account in terms of social reality, which he thought had been neglected and was primary in human reality, more than psychology or more than biology. It's sociology which is important. So all cultural forms are social forms, so all social forms can be explained by the science of society, which is sociology. And then he spawned that whole année sociologique, that whole French school of sociology, De Morse, and right the way through to Bourdieu, really. So Durkheim. But perhaps even more important than Durkheim are Marx and Weber. Now, Marx spawned a kind of Marxist sociology of religion, and his famous critique is famous definition of religion is here, which he wrote in an article towards a critique of Hegel's philosophy of right. It is very famous, this. So religious distress is at the same time the expression of real distress and also the protest against real distress. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, just as it is the spirit of a spiritless condition. It is the opium of the people. To abolish religion as the illusory happiness of the people is to demand their real happiness. The demand to give up illusions about the existing state of affairs is the demand to give up a state of affairs which needs illusions. The criticism of religion is therefore in embryo the criticism of the veil of tears, the halo of which is religion. Thus, criticism of heaven turns into criticism of earth, the criticism of religion into the criticism of law, and the criticism of theology into the criticism of politics. And he goes on to say the weapon of criticism, ideology becomes a material force when the masses grasp it, the weapon of criticism turns into the criticism of weapons. The weapon of criticism turns into the criticism of weapons, the criticism by weapons, he means, in that sense. So he's a great writer, Marx. So he says the need is to abandon religion as people's illusory happiness in order to establish the conditions for their real happiness, which is to abandon the condition that needs illusions. And he called religion ideology. For him, ideology was false consciousness. Although later Marxists like Althusser resurrect the term, for Marx it's false consciousness. As a result of and it's identified with what he calls the superstructure, which is the kind of the epiphenomenon, the icing on the cake, as a result of the interaction of the conditions of production and the forces of production and the means of production, which produce this ideology. So economics results in the ideology, in the superstructure. And the fundamental condition when he was writing of people is alienation. Now, for Hegel, alienation was the spirit, the Geist, is alienated from itself and becomes the world, if you like, becomes history, and goes back to itself in and for itself, as we were just talking about this morning. But for Marx, he turns that on its head. And alienation is the alienation of people from the products of their labour. So car, you know, factory workers in a Fordism and all that, you know, car, they work, they make a bit of a car and they're alienated from the product. But if the worker makes a whole car, then there's less alienation and there's more connection with the products of their labour. So the mechanisation of human beings he's against, which is creates alienation. There's a whole bunch of later Marxists, Lukács, Mannheim, and the Frankfurt School, right the way through to Habermas and so on. Now, Lukács is interesting. He's a Hungarian Marxist. He talks about self is alienated from the world and experiences life as fragmented. And the I sees the world as a broken reflection of itself. And this is alienation. We see the world as a broken reflection of ourselves. And this is distorted perception, which is called reification. So Lukács is famous for this term, reification. And reification is arguably fundamental to understanding the nature of religions in Marxist sociology of religion. Now, the industrialized subject, which is a vast majority of people in Europe at his time of writing, lives an inauthentic and tragic life. So he talked about the factory workers who sells her labour for a pittance and but nevertheless respects the social system and respects the system as being natural, that the system of her oppression is like nature, it's natural, it can't be challenged and can't be changed. And those attitudes are reinforced, according to Lukács, through the church, through Christianity, reinforces those, that internalization of the ideology. And this is called reification. And he wrote a book on the novel, actually, Theory of the Novel, to start with, in which he talked about the I as seeing itself as a broken reflection. And then his famous book is History of Class Consciousness, particularly Chapter 1, The Antimonies of Bourgeois Thought, which is an analysis of reification. And he analyses commodities, in which he says is the central structural problem of capitalist society. We commodify everything. Everything is commodified, made into a product to be sold. Partly due to that, relationships between people take on the quality of commodities, take on the characteristics of a thing, and become what he calls fetishized. So individuals cannot grasp the totality of society and become alienated because they can't grasp the totality. They can't grasp the totality, and secondly, their relationships are objectified in such a way as to alienate them from each other, and they become what he calls fetishized or reified. Now, the individual then, or inwardness, is a result of alienation. Inwardness is a consequence of alienation, is a symptom of alienation. Now, the classless society would have no inwardness. Once you've achieved the classless society, once the working class, the idea of the working class is eradicated, then that's also the eradication of reification and also the eradication of alienation. Now, the fundamental problem of society is that it refuses to accept the world as having arisen independently of the knowing subject. And that up till Marx and Lukács, anyway, he says that the thinking philosophy has missed the priority of the material. So we're still enthralled to an idealism, i.e. that you can't give an account of the world independently of consciousness. We're still enthralled to a philosophy of consciousness, which results in capitalism and the oppression of people, the oppression of the working class. So you have to, the working class as a subject of history has to free itself from the bounds of of its oppression through revolutionary action. So the only true subject of history is a proletariat realised in the revolutionary act for Lukács. And then the class of society is achieved once the working class itself is eradicated. Now, sociology of religion, then, is to understand how the inauthentic subject comes to be reified in late capitalism, how this reification occurs. And so the task of the sociology of religion is understanding the role of religion in people's self-oppression, in the way religion is reified, and the way the relations between people are fetishized, and therefore keeps us bound. Now, the main problems with all this, of course, are that a collectivity is not a subject. The working class isn't a subject. There's no subject of consciousness for the proletariat. It's a slightly odd idea, that. And he assumes that we can separate religion from culture and society. So religion is part of a private realm, and inwardness is cultivated through religion. And inwardness is a symptom of our alienation. So if we get rid of inwardness, we get rid of alienation. And that's also a problem, because you could argue that inwardness is a feature central to human reality, that humans are fundamentally interior beings, and that religious traditions offer an intensification of inwardness. He might not disagree with that, but Lukács would probably say, well, that's a good example of alienation, the way religions are so deeply alienating that they create this thing called inwardness, which alienates the self from its surroundings. Mm.
I say something here. Since this lady and I both belong to the same university, I taught there before she did. When I taught at Adipur, most of my colleagues were very much tied to the Lukácsian outlook.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
In fact, we used Lukács as one of the texts that people looked at. Mm. But in a creative kind of a way, because we chose some new texts that they could through which they could think about different ways in which novels showed relationships in society. And in fact, it is true that the history of the Western novel is very much a history of material relations between people.
Mm.
Interpreted by various outlooks. So and that most heroes and heroines are of the ruling upper classes, and the peasants or workers were relegated to obscurity.
Mm.
So we sought for texts that controverted that. And it's very interesting to do that kind of thing, especially since I was not a Marxist, but I learned a great deal from my Marxist colleagues, and they made me think about Western self-presentation in the novel in very helpful ways.
Mm. That's true, isn't it? I mean, from Jane Austen, right the way through, you can see...
Absolutely,
see
all this. And the novel tends to downplay religion, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
One doesn't know what the religious views of people were, but except in their social expressions, which may be rather narrow.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that sort of Marxist sociology of religion has had a big impact on Indian universities. I mean, JNU, and as you say.
Yes. And most of my colleagues, of course, were cradle Hindus.
Mm.
And therefore it was fascinating for me, as someone coming from a different tradition, to listen to what my colleagues had to say.
Yes, indeed.
About the difficulties that they had in remaining orthodox. I was learning from them and their remarks and their critiques.
Yeah, yeah. What you need is an Indian Marx, isn't it? You need a Hindu Karl Marx in a way.
Jadavpur is in West Bengal, isn't it?
Yes.
And after 35 years, just this week, the Marxist ruling party is getting thrown out. They're getting kicked out.
Yes,
Trinamool Congress is coming back with 3/4 of majority, it seems.
But the remarkable thing is that it was there for
35, over 4 decades, really.
Yeah, 35 years.
Yeah, 35 years.
That's stunning.
My husband was a kind of well-known critical friend of many of the people who were there.
Yes.
And very much of a critical friend from the Gandhian point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating to, you know, to have actually lived through in a situation where, in India, where particularly the whole Marxian critique of religion was extremely powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And often made sense to my friends.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Still is quite. I mean, you've got the Subaltern Studies Group and so on. It's about 20 years old now, but I think
absolutely.
It comes out
it
of that.
Bengalis who were right at the heart of that.
Gayatri Spivak and people like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I thought it might be,
you know, it would ground
indeed.
What you were saying
indeed.
In the actual experience of a. Of present-day India. I lived there for 30 years, so...
Yes, indeed.
You know, very well.
Yeah. It's very interesting,
though. In January, so...
Lukács should still be relevant.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
When did he live?
He died about 1930, I think.
Okay.
He went on... he was translated into English quite late.
Mm.
And in the... 70s, 80s, when I was there, he had quite a powerful influence amongst students of literature, particularly.
The early book on the novel, I think. Yeah.
Yes.
A very interesting character. He was also a Hungarian official of some kind, a diplomat or something.
I think he was, yes.
But he has a great emphasis on action. It's interesting on the primacy of action rather than thought.
Mm.
And he's a stimulating writer, really. And there's Axel Honneth is a modern German philosopher who's taken up this notion of reification. He's developing it further now, revisiting reification. So yeah, that's good. Well, we can pick up some of these strands hopefully towards the end when we look at sociology in India. The other one, of course, so there's Durkheim, Weber, Durkheim, Marx, and Weber. Finally, and he's famous for his Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which is written about 1905, and his thesis is briefly that Protestant theology, especially the Puritans, created a final intensification that developed modern capitalism. So capitalism is a result of ideas. And there's a reevaluation of work occurs as the expression of God's will. Rational capitalism is not only a method of social and economic life, but also a moral good. And so humans live to work. And that's the... Basically, the essence, here's a quote of his definition: the essence of religion is not even our concern, as we make it our task to study the conditions and effects of a particular type of social action. The external causes of religious behaviour are so diverse that an understanding of this behaviour can only be achieved from the viewpoint of the subjective experiences, ideas and purposes of the individuals concerned. In short, from the viewpoint of the religious behaviour's meaning. So he wants to link religion with meaning. And a bit like phenomenology, in the sense to put aside questions of the truth of religion, what he's interested in is its meaning and the way it functions in society, and although he's not a functionalist. And he emphasised the processes that he called rationalisation, which is that magical explanations are gradually, over the years, replaced by scientific explanations. So for Weber, religion is a key force in the history of civilizations that can't be reduced simply to social or economic factors, but which conversely influences those factors. So it's the opposite of Marx, really. Mm-hmm. So if Marx says religion is a superstructure which is a consequence of economic conditions, Weber says no, religion determines and influences and forms the economic conditions. Mm. Complex societies develop codes of conduct and laws accompanied by the rise of specialists who deal with these laws, like i.e. a priesthood. So you get this rationalization, and then you get a reaction against it in some religious groups. So you get these religious virtuosi developing, monks, priests, renouncers, who are concerned with salvation or liberation. And while the ordinary population is concerned with magical manipulation for the protection against disease and so on. So, and he argued that was still current in his time. It arguably is still now, you know. Or some years ago, I used to go to Belgium, actually, in the Ardennes, and the priest used to... we used to give the host in people's mouths, but he wouldn't give it into them in their hands because the farmers used to take it and bury it in the fields, the host, for, you know, magical to make the crops grow. So these magical practices still persist. Now, complex societies develop codes of conduct and laws accompanied by the rise of specialists who deal with those things, as I said. So, along with his ethical structure developing, you get the development of a bureaucracy, and he cites Confucianism as a good example of this. And then while the bureaucracies develop, you then get charismatic groups outside of the mainstream who are critical of the mainstream, and then become spiritual breakaway groups like Protestantism, like Luther or Protestantism, or Basavar in the Lingayats or whatever. And then you get this routinization of charisma. So charisma is a certain property attributed to individuals by a society who have a certain power, a certain charisma, which then becomes routinized. And you see this a lot with gurus and so on. So a guru starts to give a talk, starts to attract a lot of people, and they have to start organising the car park and that kind of thing. And so you get routinisation developing. Now, Weber says that with Protestantism, you get otherworldly asceticism of the monastery becomes a this-worldly asceticism of everyday life. And then surplus wealth develops through hard work and abstention. So you save your money, you don't spend it, you don't drink too much, and you work hard, and so that creates a surplus wealth. So that's where he says capitalism comes from this Protestant work ethic. And in contrast to the Marxist, he argues that the subject of history is the individual, not the collective. Although Lukács was actually influenced by Weber to some extent. And there's a whole Weberian tradition of sociology develops with the Talcott Parsons in the States, even Clifford Geertz, Peter Berger, Robert Bella, Thomas Luckmann, although he's German. And then the French sociologist Hervé Léger, who wrote that Religion is a Chain of Memory, which is very interesting, very good book. And these are the trajectories that are still present with us. So these Durkheimian and Weberian approaches create functional and substantial understandings of religion. And then developing out of all that is secularisation thesis, Brian Wilson and the other guy, Aberdeen, whose name I keep forgetting, Steve Bruce, God is Dead. Who argues for an aggressive secularisation thesis that the churches are emptying, religion is dying as people move beyond religion. Now, there are various problems in sociology of religion. First of all, there's a question, is sociology inherently atheistic? Is atheism entailed in sociology? You could argue that it was. Weber, Durkheim, Comte, all sort of great atheists, really. And also, sociology is deeply implicated in the development of modernity. So you didn't have sociology before modernity, and so the two are kind of... The project of modernity is linked to the project of sociology. And they're inherently, arguably, atheistic. Richard Roberts makes that point well. And... not Parsons. I've given you the wrong name there. It was Berger, Peter Berger, in The Sacred Canopy. Talked about methodological atheism, which he later corrected to methodological agnosticism. It could have been Cozzolinian Smart. I'm not sure if he came upon that independently. But he argued that sociology was methodologically atheistic, and it had to be. And I think he's probably right. But then he modified that to agnostic. Now, it raises the question, can religion be explained by sociology? Or is there an excess? Is there something that can't be explained? And if you adopt sociology, which models do you use? Do you use, is religion an epiphenomenon, a pure result of economic and social processes? Or does religion influence those social processes? Which is also a question about what's the relation between matter and ideas, between material processes and thought, thinking and ideology. Which is actually that a version of the basic question we were looking at last week that Husserl was picking up on about the primacy of materialism or idealism. So we can discuss some of those problems. And lastly, before we open it up to a wider discussion, the sociology of religion in India. Now, Weber wrote an important book, Religions of India. There's Dumont's Homo Hierarchicus, which is an important sociology of India. It's T.N. Madan's work on historical sociology, and particularly on the notions of Dharma. I think he even started... Did he start the Journal of Sociology, Indian Journal of Sociology?
Yes.
He started it, yeah.
Yes, he started.
Yes, that's right. And religion in India needs to be understood... Does religion in India need to be understood through the categories of sociology? And Now, sociology is a discourse that developed with Comte and so on in the West, and it gets implanted into India. Now, what happens to it there? Does India need to introduce sociology into it itself? Is that a kind of... all of these discourses which, like sociology, psychology, which get internalised in India and indeed in China, is that a kind of colonization or something? Or do those disciplines need to be rejected and transformed by those in their new context? I suspect they do, really. Or is sociology more like physics or biology or something, and therefore, or linguistics? And is therefore an objective kind of science, in which case the critique that I've just proposed wouldn't work. So that's what I have to say briefly about these these three trajectories. Now, in India, sociology, there's Marxist sociology in Bengal particularly, I think, and I don't know about Kerala. Kerala has had a Marxist government, but I don't think it has anymore. But I think it was an important influence in Kerala as well.
I think in Andhra there is still quite a considerable influence of Marxist ideas, isn't it? Amongst Dalit and and there are other people, of course, involved in this discussion, similar issues and presenting other approaches to problems.
That's right, yeah. And is sociology a purely academic discourse, or does it have a sort of social function itself, a liberationist kind of function? The way Marxist sociologists think of it. So there's a journal of sociology, I think began by Madan. But I don't know what the main kind of sociological currents are in India at the moment.
Actually, T.N. Madan has done everything theoretically, not in practical.
Ah, okay. So he wasn't an empirical sociologist.
Here, historical sociology based on dharma. So he's writing on based on such and such. But no, he didn't think about this religion or sociology of religion from the practical experience or from the practical field. How it can be correlated to more people. He didn't do that.
No.
Are there people who are doing this kind of relationship between contemporary social problems and religious traditions? Are there?
No, actual
people in academia or outside.
Actual. There are lots of thinkers and lots of writers. They thought about contemporary social problems, but in different thing, but in different pattern, like from different problems, not from religious perspective.
So sociology of religion is not particularly highlighted then. Yeah. So it's a new enterprise.
Almost.
And I think that's
academically and empirically.
And I wonder why it's like that. It's always plagued me in terms of India is supposed to have so many religious traditions.
Yes.
And they're not dead, they're alive.
Yes.
But the study of Indian religions is hardly there.
Yes.
It's weird.
And I mean, if at all there is, it's through a Marxist lens, and which will give a material. So it does not take religious tradition seriously. So, I mean, I wonder why is it like that, though it's such a religious society.
Well, yes, why is it like that?
Except West Bengal, other states are not Marxist states.
Yes.
In spite of that, it has not been progressed.
In fact, Marxism is interested in religion. I would have thought Marxism would be interested in developing sociology of religion, really, to explain it away, you know. But
there hasn't been very much direct writing, has there, though, on the subject by Marxists or their friends. What impact would you say Gandhi and Gandhism has had on thinking about religion?
Yes, Gandhi, Rabindranath Tagore has also that. Rabindranath Tagore discussed on religion of humanity, religion of man, so many things. But in spite of that, is only written, and that is only theoretical ideas.
Well, in his case, it was not. In the case of either of these men, it was not purely theoretical. It was put into practice in very different ways. And the two men were diverse in their approach.
You think in Marxist regime of West Bengal, religion, the term religion was almost forbidden.
On the other hand, when I was in Bengal in January, what really struck me was that women who I've known for the last 40, 50 years, that all of them are engaged in some kind of practical concern in helping their poorer neighbours, particularly women. They are deeply engaged in practical schemes, practical operations of one kind or another of improvement.
And I've been asking myself what the roots of this are. And I think that Rabindranath Tagore did have a tremendous influence on this view.
But one thing, you see, that 70% of women, especially rural women, every day practice religion. Without religion, they cannot pass a single day.
Mm.
So this is also true in our society.
Mm.
That's true.
Mm.
Every Bengalis, especially Hindus, and there are lots of other groups also, like Marwaris, like Biharis, like Biharis, and like so many persons from different states.
Mm-hmm.
They are engaged with lots of pujas or vows or everything.
Mm-hmm.
And every day they perform their duties, and very systematically. In spite of that, it is purely private, not public. Religion is not public. We are based on religion, but it is not public.
Mm. So the historical trajectory of modern India and its nexus with modernity,
mm-hmm.
where religion is private and secularism is what needs to be on the public front.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Probably taken with the view that if you allow religion in the public square, then a particular dominant religion is going to shelve all the other minor traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Probably that's kind of thinking that even with Jawaharlal Nehru's idea of equidistance with all religious of all religions.
Sure.
So I'm wondering whether that is one reason why religion is considered as private.
Yes.
And it's not given any space in the public realm.
Yes.
And also in terms of the whole notion of religious fundamentalism.
Mm.
Through the process of independence, the whole fight, the communal violence that has been interpreted in light of religious terminologies. So I'm not sure whether they were primarily religious conflicts at all,
okay.
But they've been interpreted as religious, in religious terminology, and they continue to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So Pakistan is not another nation state that has a conflict with India. It's Muslims
mm-hmm.
who have a problem with Indian Hindus or something.
Mm-hmm.
So this interpretation of phenomena in negative religious terminology keeps religion outside the academy and the secular public.
Actually, India has been declared a secular country.
Mm-hmm.
So secularism is the superficial feature. But underneath that secularism, every people of every state perform their duties.
Mm.
That is purely own religious duties. And but openly, it is one type of close society. Close society relating to religion. What is? Because we always talk about secularism, because there are so many groups, Hindu, Muslim, and so many groups.
Mm-hmm.
And our religion is also based on politics also.
Mm.
Politics and religion are... they are like two things
mm.
and closely related to each other.
Mm.
So that is... that is one reason for this closeness.
Mm.
I'm going to move to something else. So, if you want to sort of build on this, I suggest you.
Just one common problem. I mean, your last question on religion in India needs to be understood through the categories of sociology. Does it have to be?
Mm.
I think it needs to be understood the categories that come out of its own tradition.
That's right.
Mm. I mean, then it'll make more sense.
Mm.
But there appears to be no public space for that to happen.
Okay.
There's something bottlenecking Indian traditions or lack of a general confidence probably in its own traditions to allow its categories to stand at par with sociological or academic categories that come from the West.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, why should it adopt the categories that come from the West, as you say? Yeah.
what would be the inherent indigenous categories that it would need.
But surely the indigenous categories involve tremendous tension and suspicion among different religious groups. I think that simply blaming the West for everything that is now happening or has happened is a kind of escape clause, isn't it?
I mean, I totally agree with you. I think it's not to blame the West at all. I mean, that's part of the history of India, so you can't escape the history. But why do we have to say that there are conflicts between the Vaishnavas and the Shaivites? Or, I mean, there doesn't have to be a necessary conflict. I mean, if there's a postmodern hermeneutical approach to the study of religious traditions, which would allow equal space for different traditions to coexist and dialogue with one another, then won't that provide a platform for all religious traditions, not just religious, all traditions as such, to grow together and provide a rich matrix for everyone to grow together?
But don't you think memories are really so very strong and so very recent? So many people are still terribly close to the Calcutta killings, to the decimation of communities by one another, to the migration involving thousands, if not more, from one place to another because of religious differences. And that is a tremendous blockage in the mind when one wishes to overcome prejudice all around. Yesterday I was talking to my daughter, who works in London and is Indian, and she said, "Oh, Mommy, I'm not going to these Rabindranath celebrations because people come round to saying how terrible Muslims are, and I don't want to be part of that." Self-congratulation placing of one's own social group as superior in some sense to others in London. This is how life
tribalism.
Is.
Yeah.
But one thing I have observed that suppose if any person wants to perform his own religion, there is no force or no, that is not forbidden. Because suppose few peoples are Vaishnavas, so they can easily perform their own duties and openly. Nobody will give them any
trouble,
any obstacles or anything. So this is also true in our Bengali society. And in India also, nobody will say that don't do this and don't do that. So everybody is free, liberal to do any, to perform any.
I wonder if religion has become the scapegoat in representation of our problems in the country. For example, I was doing some work on this whole Christian-Hindu conflicts, and in Orissa especially. It was not really a problem between Christianity and Hinduism. It was between two tribal groups, one tribe and one caste, the Khans and the, I forget the other group. It was a problem of land, and that goes back to the 19th century. I mean, it was long before Christianity even came into that area. But politically, because religion is privatized and there is no religious voice, so you can scapegoat it and make it look like a Hindu-Christian conflict. And immediately that brand has got value and privilege and currency within the larger media. And immediately in reaction to that, there were problems in Bangalore, in Karnataka, in Andhra, between Hindus and Christians. And now legitimately it has become a Hindu-Christian problem.
Yes.
Whereas originally it was not a Hindu-Christian.
Land, yeah.
It was about purely about land.
Yeah.
And
between two different groups who happen to be.
And the reality was, is very, the Naxalites in that coastal area, ethnically, are Christians.
Yeah.
But then that won't be revealed in the story, that it'll be a Naxalite problem. It won't be a Christian Naxalite who is actually trying to do some work, you know. Or the Khans, who are generally averse to Christianity, wouldn't accept the conversion thing. But they are, what's the thing? I think they own the land. And it was the Christian Dalit who cannot, I mean, there was this whole tribal land cannot be given away outside the tribal bounds. They were lost to it. And so those were the real conflicts. But if you mention that in public media, who is interested in that? I mean, it is not power. That story has no power in that story. So to represent it in religious categories, and religion does not have a voice in the public square. So there's nobody to defend religion and say, well, is it really a religious issue?
Yeah.
So then it starts to get termed in religious terminology, and everybody's happy with that.
But if there was a public realm where religion could be discussed, that kind of thing wouldn't happen.
It hasn't happened yet.
Interesting.
To go back to Rabindranath, though, and his impact, there was an article I read last week about him, you know, in this country, which was praising his educational work in what seemed to me to be rather sentimental terms, which some translation has allowed to happen. And I was myself impelled to write a reply to that, which drew attention to our friend Uma Dasgupta's book about Rabindranath and social life, in which she makes a very clear and concise analysis of how, right from his early days, he was tremendously troubled by the fact that his father owned land possessed by Bangladeshi Muslims who were extremely poor and who were being affected in all kinds of ways by his possession of their land. And so he begins thinking about what can be done. And again, in Bengal, he is tremendously aware that if he set up a school, his neighbours are tribal, and that nothing is being done to improve their social situation. So when he wins the Nobel Prize, what does he do with the money? What do you think he does? Do you know?
Gives it away.
He founds a cooperative bank in Shantiniketan. And that is very seldom mentioned. Uma Dasgupta mentions it. I thought that was really wonderful, just superb, because it shows a practical, here is a reformist Hindu who has himself, through his family, thought about his own traditions and jettisoned certain practices and simplified his Hindu faith to a degree that he himself and his friends can accept. And then it turns his attention rather to society in general and what he can say to his Indian brethren and sisters about how to live life. And it seemed to me that was wonderfully, I was re-inspired by rereading Uma Dasgupta's book. Rabindranath biography, OUP, 2004, I think it is. Quite inspiring.
Yep. And if you had lots of those kinds of things going on, it would really have a big effect.
It would.
Society.
Yes. I feel Uma Dasgupta's book, for example, has not been publicised sufficiently within India.
No, we never
so that people
it.
Know about this. And this 150th anniversary of Rabindranath's birth is a terribly important time for this whole outlook to be made more widely known throughout India. Here is someone who remains a Hindu with certain reservations, but is as practically engaged as others in his time. And of course, he wasn't the only one. I think he was. Yeah, the fascinating thing is that Ramakrishna Mission was also engaged in a kind of turnabout, wasn't it, in Bengal, from pure spiritualism to thinking about social problems. and which has continued. So when I went to India, the Asiatic Society, where did they put me to live for a fortnight? The Ramakrishna Mission guest house, which was wonderful, because there I was meeting, I met a Muslim gentleman who lives in London, and whose writing I had read, but he was there visiting around. And other Indians who were visiting from America, who'd settled in America, they were all there. And I was there to give my lecture, and it was wonderful.
Such a delightful time.
And there were people coming from different parts of Europe and other places, also there to study Hinduism. So things are happening quietly.
And you've now got the sociology of religion developing too, which is good.
Can I?
Yeah, go on.
I mean, you mentioned here Robert's. I don't know if it's a criticism or a concern or just an observation that sociology of religion is inherently sort of an atheism. Has anyone sort of developed a sort of a different sociology of religion? I mean, is it possible, or has anyone tried that, or is this something that sort of? I mean, I look at Weber, and sort of. I mean, I think the methodological agnosticism seems to be sort of a prerequisite, but. I don't think it necessarily goes sort of against.
No, I think I agree with you.
With Marx, it's perhaps slightly different. But has anyone ever?
I think
developed something like that.
I think what's his name up in Nottingham? I think Milbank is argues for this, really, that sociology is inherently atheistic. Kind of a negative reflection of theology. You can't develop a theological understanding of society.
False religion.
Sociology is false religion.
And in an interesting kind of way, Terry Eagleton, Marxist wing, he is also now writing. I'm reading a book by him at the moment about ethics. Which is using the tools provided by sociology and by his political judgment to say some very interesting things. Since he's tried to do the tremendously awkward thing of remaining a kind of Christian and
I didn't know that.
And a Marxist at the same time.
He's a
how he does it is fascinating.
I read his discourse from religion, I can't remember what it's called now, a book he did about a year ago. He's having a go at Dawkins. It's very good, very interesting.
Yes, he's coming out on behalf of religion.
He's coming out on behalf of religion.
All kinds of trends.
It's a crude atheism, right?
Fascinating, scientism. I think.
Which is blind to its social location, really.
One thing I want to know from you, is there any model to introduce sociology of religion, model of any society or any country, which can be compared to Indian society? Because Indian society, you see, since 4,000 years back or 5,000 BC, Indian society is always talking about religion, and so many epics are there, so many books on religion are there. But still, today, in the 2011, is not fully concerned about religion. That is one perspective. But is there any model that how it developed? So that model can be an example to follow for this country also.
Wow. Yeah. I think India's unique. I can't think of a... Well, Marx had an account, didn't he? But, you know, religion would wither away eventually. But you're talking about models of sociology that you could apply, or methods or something that you could... A lens through which you could view Indian society. What Brainerd was saying, it has to develop its own self-understanding, its own categories.
Yes.
Rather than import something from Weber or something. Weber wrote a good book on religions in India. But
did he live in India? Actually?
I don't think he ever went there, no.
That's what I was wondering.
No, I don't think he ever went there. Who was over here? Molly Williams, he used to dissuade his, he used to tell us you shouldn't go to India, you know.
Max Muller.
Molly Williams spent a lot of time in India. Yeah, Molly Williams did. Yeah. It was Max Muller who dissuaded his students. Well, thanks for coming to this, everyone. And next week we're looking at psychology of religion. In last week, we looked at politics. It's all very ABC, so do come if you're interested.